So what I want to do today, so there's this last remaining business that I wanted to cover as part of the first section of the course called Fundamentals. And then we'll go into the second section of the course that I'm calling Congruences, and I'll explain what the word is supposed to mean as we get there. So we already started the discussion of Riemann normal coordinates last time, but only in the broadest sense. And I was talking about the fact that for any curve manifold, it's always possible to find a coordinate system so that around any given point, the metric there will look as, as closely to Minkowski as possible. So that's the notion that around the very small patch, you can always think of a curve manifold as being locally flat, and you can always come up with coordinates that will look as close to Euclidean coordinates as is possible, given the fact that we do have curvature somewhere in the manifold. And one way of realizing this is to do a very specific construction that gives rise to those Riemann normal coordinates. So I'll do that first, and then I'll talk about Fermi coordinates. And I'll keep the discussion fairly short. I'm not going to provide derivations here. Those can be found, but I just wanted you to make sure that you're aware of this and that sometimes it's really advantageous to deal with coordinate systems that satisfy those properties that can help set up calculations. And I'm always in favor of finding coordinate systems that help me do things as opposed to insisting always on using coordinate-free methods. I'm very much a physicist in that way. Mathematicians would really find that point of view very strange, but I have no problems using coordinates as a way to help me in life. All right, so here's the construction. So the idea is that we're working at some point P, and in a very small neighborhood around that point, we're going to be able to qualify that in a moment, quantify that in a moment. And what I'm going to do at that point is to select directions that are going to be mutually orthogonal. So I'm going to be basically erecting a set of basis vectors at that point, and I'm going to insist that they're all orthogonal to one another. So more or less, I'm doing here in a curve manifold what I would be doing in flat space if I wanted to construct Cartesian coordinates. And in fact, the spirit is very much the same, except that in flat space, if we wanted to set up Cartesian coordinates, we would use straight lines as a way of defining things. Here, we're not going to be using straight lines. We're going to be using the next best thing, which are geodesics. All right, so the first step is construct an orthonormal basis of vectors, and I'm going to call them E alpha mu. Mu is going to be a label. We're going to have the T, X, Y, and Z labels, and alpha would be the usual space-time index at our point P. And that just means that we're going to start with one direction that we're going to think of as maybe time. We're going to set up an orthogonal direction that's going to be one of our spatial directions. We're going to set up another orthogonal direction that's going to be our second spatial direction, and then there would be a third, but I'm not able to draw this on the board. A fourth one, I mean, but I'm not able to draw this on the board. So this would be E0, this would be E1, this would be E2, and then there would be an E3 that points somewhere in the fourth dimension. And the idea is that all the angles here are 90 degrees, so they're all orthogonal to one another. So this means that if I take the inner product of any one of those vectors with another one of those vectors, I will get either plus or minus one. So I will be getting the Minkowski metric out of that. So that I get just by, building some vectors here. And what I want to do is to define coordinates that will refer to a choice of origin, that's RP here, and refer to a selected point that I might pick somewhere in the neighborhood of that point, sorry, in the neighborhood of P. I'm going to have a second point Q, and I want to define the coordinates of that point. And the way we're going to do this is, well, we're going to look at going from P to Q. And what we're going to do here is to take a unique geodesic that allows us to go from P to Q. So we're going to assume here that the neighborhood around P is small enough that we have a unique geodesic that will reach any given point within that neighborhood from our choice of origin. So if I change the point, I'm going to be changing the geodesic. But regardless, there's going to be a unique geodesic relating the two points. So the step two is we're going to select the unique, and it's important here because otherwise we wouldn't have a well-defined coordinate system if we couldn't do that. We're going to select the unique geodesic that relates Q to P. And the statement here is that if the neighborhood is small enough, we're guaranteed to find that unique geodesic between the two points. And depending on the causal relationship between P and Q, we might be talking about a time-like geodesic, we might be talking about a space-like geodesic, we might be talking about a null geodesic, but there's going to be some geodesic that does that. So that's our geodesic. And that geodesic will be coming with a tangent vector that's going to be parallel transported on that geodesic. And that tangent vector I will call n. So that geodesic comes with a tangent vector n. And I'm going to be assuming that the parameterization of the geodesic is in terms of either proper time or proper distance. The null case is an exception. We'll not worry about that right now, but for typical situations, we'll have either a time-like or a space-like geodesic, and I will choose that vector to be normalized. So it's going to be either plus or minus one, depending on whether we're dealing with a time-like geodesic parameterized with proper time, or a space-like geodesic parameterized with proper distance. In the null case, the choice of normalization is always a little bit tricky, and it's a bit of a singular set of points that we're dealing with here, but we're not going to be worrying about that. Okay, so that's one thing. So we have that tangent vector that's tangent to the geodesic, and it's defined at any point along the geodesic, but I'm really interested in its value at the origin. And what I'm going to do is to decompose that tangent vector in the basis that we were given there. So we're going to decompose n alpha, the tangent vector, in the orthonormal basis. And that's something we can express as a decomposition that's going to look like, I'm going to write it like this, where the n mu are going to be the coefficients in that decomposition. So the n mu are just going to be the inner product between the tangent vector and the basis vectors, and they appear as coefficients. Given the choice of geodesic, that vector is unique, and therefore the coefficients are unique as well. And now we're ready to state the definition. The Riemann normal coordinates, I'm going to call them x mu, they're going to be, by definition, the proper distance or proper time between P and Q. Times the direction provided by those expansion coefficients. That's the definition. So it's basically a construction that's very geometrical. We're using geodesics in order to construct a coordinate system. We're using very well-defined directions here that give us the direction to the geodesic that takes us from P to Q. And then we're using proper time or proper distance as an integral part of the definition. So if you're thinking about this and take a step back and ask yourself, how will we define Cartesian coordinates in flat space? while I say that the construction is exactly the same, that's how we would define Cartesian coordinates in flat space. The only distinction is that in flat space, when I say geodesic, we would be talking about straight lines. But other than that, what are Cartesian coordinates? Well, they're basically distance away from the origin measured along the straight line times the direction cosines that are provided to us by the direction of the line given to us by a unit vector that points in that direction. So that construction is exactly what we would use to construct Cartesian coordinates at any given point, given a set of directions. And here, all we're doing is to adapt the construction to something that applies to curved spacetime. Namely, we replaced a straight line of Cartesian coordinates to the next best thing, which is a geodesic. And so long as we have a unique geodesic relating the two points, we're all fine. If the neighborhood is too large, we run into a situation where those geodesics may cross, and we run into situations like this where the coordinates become multi-valued, and that means that they're basically breaking down as a coordinate system. But that's fine. All we have to do is to make sure that this applies to a small neighborhood, and if the neighborhood is small enough, then all the geodesics are unique and everything is fine. So that's the construction.
Can I have a question?
Yes, please.
X mu is the coordinate of Q, right?
The coordinates of Q, yeah, that's right. So I might indicate this like that. And then if you change the point, you change the geodesic, you change the direction cosines, you change the distance, and then the coordinates change accordingly.
Yes, thank you.
All right, good. Any questions here? Yeah?
So what is a small enough neighbor?
Right, so that's a complicated question. And it would depend, we're going to see in a moment that, well, the curvature will enter in the discussion of the metric, so it really depends on how far you're allowed to go given the scale of distance provided by the curvature. And if you try to go too far, you run into those situations where geodesics start crossing, and that scale is dictated by the curvature. So on the surface of the Earth, we know that, you know, geodesics, the great circles, are unique until they start crossing at the North Pole. That gives you an idea that, well, on the scale of the radius of the Earth, we run into a breakdown of the construction. But if we stay clear of that, if we stay smaller than this, then everything is good. And, you know, it's always going to be a property of those coordinate systems that are not meant to apply globally. They're just meant to describe a small patch around a given point.
So if I were to imagine doing like P and Q around a Schwarzschild black hole, if I'm far away, I could probably deviate a lot. But if I'm very close to the center, then I can only deviate a little bit before.
That's right. Right. Yeah, yeah. So that's right. So I'll make this a bit more clear in a moment. But yeah, it's the curvature that decides on the smallness of the patch. If the curvature is very, very strong, then the patch must be very, very small. If the curvature is very small, then the patch can be very large. And in the limit where there's no curvature, then the patch can be all of space, right? All of space-time. Okay, so at this point, what I could do, and you know, it wouldn't be that hard, but it would take some time, I could go into a derivation of the fact that if I'm using this construction and using those as coordinates, here's the metric that we would get. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to state what the metric is, and then I'll leave it at that because, you know, those are things you can find in the literature. And my purpose was not to do all of this in great depth, but just to mention the ideas and make you aware that these things are, you know, available and useful for all sorts of things. So that's going to be enough over here. So given all of this, then the statement and the promise is that you could calculate the form of the metric given the construction around the point P, and it will look like this. In that coordinate system, the metric is going to be at leading order the Minkowski metric, so we're guaranteed that this will respect the locally Minkowski form of the metric, but then there's going to be corrections. And the correction will involve explicitly the Riemann tensor evaluated at that reference point P. So it's going to be the Riemann tensor. I have to look up the indices to make sure I don't mess them up. It's the Riemann tensor evaluated at that origin point P, and that multiplies x lambda x rho. And then, you know, we could keep going like this, but we would generate corrections that would be of higher order in the displacement, and they would go like S cubed divided by the radius of curvature cubed. So the point here is that that quadratic combination here, quadratic in the coordinates, is something that describes something of order the displacement squared. And the curvature itself comes with a scale that we call the radius of curvature. And that the curvature scales as 1 over the radius of curvature squared. That's, you know, trying to draw a curly R here, and I'm failing. So what we're introducing essentially here is an expansion of the metric in powers of that ratio of displacement divided by the radius of curvature. And so long as that ratio is small, this will make a small correction to the Minkowski form. But if we wanted higher order corrections for some purposes, and sometimes we do, there's a method to generate the cubic terms, the quartic terms, and in principle, you can go to very high order in this. And every time you go higher in order, you introduce more information. At this order, it's just a curvature. At that order, we would introduce curvature gradients. At the next order, it would be curvature differentiated twice, and also curvature squared terms. So it keeps going like this. It keeps becoming more complicated. But that, you know, that's the leading order correction, where we see that the curvature prevents us from claiming that, you know, the metric can be flat everywhere. It cannot be flat everywhere because of the existence of curvature. So that's the form of the metric in Riemann normal coordinates with, you know, a very, very geometrical and satisfying construction. And what we see from this is that if we look at the metric at the point P, namely where x is 0, we get precisely the Minkowski metric. So that's the notion that at any given point, we can always introduce coordinates such that the metric is Minkowski at a given point. And on top of that, if we take a first derivative of the metric, we'll turn those quadratic terms here into linear terms. But if we set x equal to 0 at the point P, we're going to get 0. And that tells us that it's not just that the metric becomes Minkowski, it's also that the Christoffel symbols at that point can be set equal to 0. And the beautiful thing about this is that, you know, if you're calculating a complicated tensorial expression with lots of covariant derivatives, well, if you do that in Riemann normal coordinates at the given point P, you can kill all the Christoffel symbols, all the covariant derivatives become partial derivatives, and you can really use this as a dramatic way to simplify the calculation. And that's the kind of thing that is done all the time. So we always appeal to a coordinate system where we can enforce those conditions. Sometimes how to achieve those coordinates is never mentioned, but now you see that, well, there's a very nice geometrical construction that allows us to get here, and once we're here, well, we have those conditions that can be very useful when it's time to do a very complicated calculation involving large tensors with many, you know, many covariant derivatives. So that's the idea, that we can always do this. We can always, you know, set those conditions in some specialized coordinate system, and the Riemann normal coordinates is an implementation of this. It's not the unique implementation of this, but it is one construction that allows us to achieve this, and I find that it's a very satisfying one because all the ideas involved in this are all very nicely geometrical. Any coordinate system that implements these conditions will always have a form like this where the correction appears at second order, but the precise, you know, combination here, the precise coefficients here, would differ from construction to construction. That's what the Riemann coordinates give us. And then, you know, if you were to compute second derivatives of the metric, of course, you would get something, you know, non-zero, because after you're done differentiating twice, you would kill those factors of x. You would get something proportional to the Riemann tensor. And in fact, you can check that calculating the Riemann tensor from this metric gives you the Riemann tensor. Otherwise, it would be, very bad. But we do, we do have that. So if you were to calculate the Riemann tensor from this metric, you would find that, well, it's only the second derivative terms in the metric that show up. And then you would be able to verify that the Riemann tensor here is really the one that corresponds to the Riemann tensor of that metric. So it's all internally consistent. Otherwise, of course, we would run into trouble. Yep.
Is there anything stopping me from doing this at like every point in space-time?
No.
Like I'm imagining a numerical relativity where I have two different points I want to evolve the metric on, and at each point I just install their own Riemann normal coordinates on, evolve them, and then maybe later on transfer to a coordinate system that's compatible for both of them.
Yeah, so the hard part would be in reconciling the local constructions with the global coordinate system.
Right.
That's where all your effort would have to go, and that would make things messy in the end. So that's why we normally don't use normal coordinates unless we choose to work at a neighborhood and that's enough for our purposes. Typically, it's a lot more useful to use a global coordinate system if you want to have global information about, a metric that evolves in time, for example. But in principle, it could be done, right? In principle, we could choose to work in local patches that are all Riemann and then try to reconcile all of those patches at a later stage. But that would require a lot of technical, nasty stuff. So,
I mean, does it even matter that, say, I have constructed this metric as it evolves in time, but each point is a different coordinate system? Does that make it not useful?
So while it would depend on what you intend to do in the end, but if in the end you want to reconstruct the entire space-time, I think you would have to present it in one, unique coordinate system that applies globally. And that's what would give you the technical issues of reconstructing that from all the local patches. But, if you're interested in doing, a very local calculation that would apply at a point, that point perhaps being generic, then that would be perfectly fine, and I think that's a useful thing to do. I think it can really clarify a lot of difficult calculations if you just say let's use those coordinates and then see what the outcome is, and then you can always reconvert the outcome into something that applies in any coordinate system. That's a standard thing that we always do, and I'll do a ton of that in future lectures. Okay, other questions before we move on? Okay, good.
Spin connection.
Yes, one
time,
please.
A spin connection, how we can relate them to the derivative of the tetrads?
So here the tetrad, the orthonormal basis that I introduced at the beginning is defined at a point only. I could choose to, do things to define it elsewhere. An option would be to say that if I define it at a point, I can define it elsewhere by parallel transport. I could do that. But here, the point is that for the construction, I just need the tetrad at one given point, and that's it. So there are no notion of differentiating that or extending it to other points in the neighborhood. There was another question. Guess not. Okay. So that's Riemann coordinates, and they're defined in a neighborhood of a given point. A really amazing thing is that this whole business can be extended to a whole geodesic. So we can define normal coordinates that will achieve exactly the same properties for the metric around an entire geodesic. And those are Fermi coordinates. And, I consider Fermi coordinates to be a really wonderful thing. And I really like working with them whenever I have the chance. So Fermi is the Fermi that we know from all the work he did on nuclear physics and particle physics. But before he did any of this, he dabbled in general relativity. I think he may have been an undergraduate at the time. And you know, he came up with this. All right, so the idea is, you know, is very similar. And in fact, the construction is almost the same, except that we're not going to fix an origin. We're going to fix a geodesic. So we're given, so here I'm going to take the geodesic to be time-like just for, you know, for concreteness, but it could be a space-like geodesic. So that's going to be a time-like geodesic. And what I want to claim is that the coordinates we'll be building are going to be such that it's going to be Minkowski everywhere on the geodesic at any point on the geodesic. The first derivative of the metric is going to be zero at any point, but then we're going to run into non-zero second derivatives. Okay, so the idea is very similar. So now I have to do a bit more infrastructure because I'm not talking about working at a point, I'm talking about working on the entire word line. So the first thing I'm going to do here is to pick a point on my word line, and I'm going to construct an orthonormal basis at that point. So at this point, it's basically the same starting point. So I'm going to pick an orthonormal frame, and I'm going to choose the zeroth member of that frame to be the tangent vector to the geodesic. So I'm going to make that choice. And after that, I'm going to pick one spatial direction. I'm going to pick another spatial direction. And I'm going to pick a third spatial direction. They're all going to be orthogonal to one another. But the only choice that I make that's sort of prescribed ahead of time is the fact that I'm going to choose the zeroth member to be tangent to the vector. So we're going to pick a point on gamma, and we're going to construct an orthonormal basis with the zeroth member, as I said, being identified with the tangent vector to the word line. And I'm thinking of the word line as being parameterized by proper time, so the tangent vector itself is a normalized vector. And that gives me, as we had before, a set of inner products. A set of inner products that are all zero or ones, plus or minus ones. And that gives me the Minkowski metric. You know, that's how it arises in the calculations. Okay, so that's at a given point, but I'm going to need an orthonormal basis like this at every point on the geodesic. So I'm going to need one at any point, including that one over here. So to get all of those from the first one that I start with, I'm going to use parallel transport as a way of traveling up the geodesic. So we're going to use, so we're going to define the orthonormal basis at any point on gamma by parallel transport. So parallel transport will ensure that the zeroth member will stay tangent to the geodesic, because being a geodesic, the tangent vector is itself parallel transported. And then all the other vectors will remain at right angles, at 90 degree angles, with respect to all of the other basis vectors. So that's something that is preserved by parallel transport. And then from the construction at one point here, we obtain one on every single point on the geodesic. So that's how we get a tetrad. Yeah, that's what we call a set of four vectors like this everywhere on the geodesic. So those are the first steps. After that, what we're going to do is as follows. So here's the geodesic. here's a point over here. No, let me not select that point over here. So I'm going to start with a given point in a neighborhood of that geodesic. And again, you know, it cannot be too far off. It has to be fairly close, as, you know, with a notion that depends on the scale of curvature around that geodesic gamma. And then what I'm going to do is to draw all the possible geodesics that start off at Q. But I want to select the one, it's going to be a unique one again, that's going to intersect gamma at right angles. So it's going to be orthogonal to gamma at the point of intersection. So you can imagine launching all the geodesics that can start at Q, and then finding the unique one that's going to encounter gamma and cross it orthogonally. So here's that geodesic. And the stipulation here is that it has to be orthogonal to the velocity vector at that point. So the third step is we're going to select the unique. Again, we're guaranteed to have uniqueness if we work in a small enough neighborhood. We're going to select the unique geodesic that links gamma to Q and crosses gamma orthogonally. And what this means is that if I pick out the tangent vector to that geodesic at that point of intersection, then that is going to be at right angles relative to the fourth, the zeroth member of the tetrad, or the velocity vector. So what this means is that at P at on gamma, the scalar product between the tangent vector to the geodesic and the zeroth member of the tetrad, that's going to be zero. So that's basically supplying a boundary condition here and a boundary condition here. We have two pieces of boundary data. We have a second order differential equation to solve. There's going to be a unique solution that satisfies those two conditions, namely that it has to start here and it has to end here. And here is going to be selected by the statement that it has to end on the geodesic with a right angle, you know, crossing. Okay, so that was the key step, and after that, it's more or less the same. So we're going to do a decomposition of the tangent vector into the orthonormal basis that lives at that point of encounter over here. And now the expansion is going to involve three terms instead of four, because one of those coefficients is guaranteed to be zero. So the expansion we're going to get is going to have the form nj ej, where here I'm excluding the zeroth member from the sum. So that excludes e0 from the decomposition, because we've already said that that coefficient is going to be zero. And now we're done. We can define the Fermi coordinates. Of the point Q. And here we have to specify the time coordinate and the spatial coordinates. And the time coordinate of the point Q, well, by definition, that's going to be proper time at the intersection point. So I have a geodesic here parameterized by proper time. And proper time will have a very specific value here. And I'm going to say that the time coordinate of point Q is going to be the same as the time coordinate of the intersection point. So I might as well call that intersection point P, and basically say that proper time for point Q related to P this way is going to be, so the time coordinate of Q is going to be the proper time evaluated at P, that intersection point. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that the spatial coordinates, xj at Q Well, it's going to be the same story. It's going to be the proper distance. Now it's sure to be a proper distance instead of proper distance or proper time, because we know that being orthogonal to a time-like direction, the geodesic is going to be a space-like geodesic. So it's going to be proper distance from P to Q, multiplying those expansion coefficients. So it's basically the same construction, but now with a little bit more detail added, because we do have a breakdown between time and space that's provided to us, you know, free of charge by the geodesic. So that's defining the coordinates. And then what we could do, and I actually have a section in the book that, you know, does that explicitly, so you can look this up. That gives us, you know, after a bit of work, an expression for the metric. And I'll just write it down here, provide no derivations. We have that GTT is going to be, well, to leading order, it's going to be the Minkowski value minus 1. And there's going to be a correction term involving the Riemann tensor. I'll write it like this, Riemann tensor TPTQ. That's a Riemann tensor that will be a function of time, because it's going to be the Riemann tensor that we evaluate at, you know, the appropriate point on the geodesic gamma. So it's going to be the same time that refers to the Q time over here. So it's going to be the Riemann tensor evaluated specifically at that point. And that multiplies spatial coordinate P, spatial coordinate Q, and then we have something of higher order added to this. And, you know, if we really wanted, you know, more terms, we could generate them with the general methods that are used to, you know, do this calculation. So that's the time-time component. The time-space component, well, those would start at zero, because that's what Minkowski tells us. And that starts right away at second order with a Riemann tensor term. And here I'll write it as JPQT, evaluated at the correct time t, and that multiplies again xp xq, and then we have higher order terms. And finally, the spatial metric, spatial part of the metric, well, it's going to start with the Minkowski values, and then again there's going to be minus a third, there's going to be a curvature correction rjpk Q, XP, XQ, plus higher order terms. So the geometric construction gives us a metric that looks like this, and a metric that starts with the Minkowski values when x is equal to zero, with correction terms that are quadratic in the coordinates, in the, you know, displacements away from the geodesic, and with linear terms absent. So that means that we have a metric that satisfies the flatness condition, not just at a point, but on a entire geodesic. And we also have a metric that, I'll just write it in terms of the Christoffel symbols, a metric where you can set the Christoffel symbols, you know, to zero, not just at a point, but along the entire geodesic. So that's a nice construction that allows us to claim those properties for the metric and the Christoffel symbols. And sometimes that's all you need to know. You don't even need to know more information about the, you know, the curvature terms in the metric, so you can just rely on those properties. But it's nice to know how you might construct those coordinates. And that's the construction right here. So very nicely geometrical, very, you know, very nice set of ideas. And they give us a metric that has a very convenient form satisfying those properties here. So two more remarks about this. So in the notes that I posted, I do a calculation of, I do a derivation of the geodesic equation as it, you know, as it appears in that coordinate system. So if you imagine that you have another geodesic over here, and you want to work out the geodesic equation in Fermi coordinates, well, that's something that can be done. And in fact, it can be done very easily on the basis of the Lagrangian that we wrote down that, you know, could be applied here as well as it could be applied in general coordinate systems. And if you work out the geodesic equations in that coordinate system, it looks very close. In fact, it's identical to the equation of geodesic deviation that we worked out using covariant methods before. So I don't want to go through those details here because it's something we encountered before, but you know, the reason for including it in the notes is to make the point that using this coordinate system, the derivation of the geodesic deviation equation is very direct and immediate, requires no, you know, cleverness of manipulating, you know, Riemann tensors and things like that. You can just work it out very directly. And the point is that the geodesic equation here, if you write it down in terms of Fermi coordinates, well, it's really comparing this motion to that motion. So it's really comparing the motion of one geodesic with respect to another. So that's why the geodesic deviation equation comes out of this, because that's really what we're doing. It's just that now we're adapting the calculation using one of those geodesics, the reference geodesic, as a point of origin, measuring everything else relative to that. So it gives us another, you know, way of appreciating what that equation means. And the point is that it all comes out of this calculation, you know, very, very easily. So that's one point I wanted to make. So you can find that in the posted notes, but I won't go through those details here. The other point I wanted to make is that it's possible to adapt this construction to a word line that is not geodesic. You can introduce a word line that's actually accelerated in space-time, and you could apply exactly the same steps. Everything would go through, except that what would not happen is that all the correction terms would appear at quadratic order. If you introduced an accelerated word line here, you would generate terms at first and second order that actually depends on the acceleration of the curve. So you would still be able to enforce this, but you would not be able to enforce that if you were talking about an accelerated curve as a point of origin, because after you're done taking a derivative, you would still end up with non-zero terms that actually correspond to the acceleration of the word line. So the Fermi coordinates give you this because the reference word line is a geodesic, but the construction can be adapted to non-geodesics, but you get some of the properties, but not all of the properties. So that's something to be aware of. Sometimes it's useful to introduce an accelerated word line as a point of origin and just modify the construction to account for that accelerated word line. And then you end up with a more complicated version of the metric with linear terms. But, you know, that can still be a convenient point to set up a calculation. And, you know, those are things that I've done certainly in the past for some, you know, some things that I did. All right. Questions about this?
What if you have a null curve? I mean, the null curve doesn't work, right?
No. So the construction badly breaks down for a null curve because you sort of lose the notion of having an orthogonal encounter here. And maybe something could be adapted, but I think there would be a need for more ingredients, and yeah, I've never seen that done actually. So, oh, if you're dealing with a whole null surface, then yeah, there are things you can do, and we'll talk about that to set up a coordinate system that's adapted to a full null hypersurface. But here, I think we have to think of this as applying only to space-like or time-like curves. It's useful for time-like curves and time-like geodesics. I don't think it's as useful for space-like ones, but you know, you could imagine that, you know, this could be also carried over to a space-like construction.
Can you not just think of two null vectors, one going long and one going anti-long way?
Yeah, so you would have to introduce more ingredients like this, and I think that might spoil the sort of appeal of the construction, and it would certainly give you more complexity in the resulting metric. And I guess, you know, I don't know why you would use a null curve as a point of reference here. The idea is that, you know, you can think of you as an observer moving on that word line, and you could use those coordinates as a way of representing what measurements you might carry out as an observer, because, you know, the construction is really about setting yourself up as the origin of your coordinate system and setting out rulers that will point in orthogonal directions, so you can really relate this to actual measurement protocols that anybody would do in a curved space-time around their immediate neighborhood. And you can see that, well, curvature will introduce subtle things in your frame that sets a limitation as how you can talk about the equivalence principle. You can talk about the equivalence principle in a small neighborhood, but if the neighborhood becomes too large, then those curvature terms will start producing something that is measurable. Those are the tidal forces of gravity. So in that sense, I mean, that motivates the use of a time like geodesic, or at least a time like accelerated word line as, you know, as a choice of origin. I'm not sure why you would introduce a null geodesic as a point of origin for a coordinate system, because I can't think of anybody doing measurements moving with the speed of light. So, you know, that's, you know, maybe there would be some purposes to do this, but I don't know what they would be. Okay, good with that. Any questions online? Okay, so that finishes off that first section of the course, and now I'm gonna change gears a bit and do something else. So that's the start of section two of the course on congruences. And I'll explain the meaning of the word before I go too far, but because we're going to be doing this for quite a few lectures, I want to give you the roadmap of where we're going with this and give you the reason why I'm going to be doing all of that stuff that I'm going to be doing in the next several lectures. And the motivation for this is that at some point I want to talk about black holes. And when we talk about black holes, we talk about event horizons. And when we talk about event horizons, we're talking about a causal boundary in space-time, and therefore we're talking about a null surface. So let's imagine that we have a null surface defined in some space-time, and we can think of this as some event horizon, but, you know, let's say that this is the context. So we have some null hypersurface in space-time. And the property of null hypersurfaces is that you can always imagine a null surface like this to be traced by null geodesics. So if you're given any null hypersurface like an event horizon, coming with it is a network of null geodesics that are all nice and non-intersecting in all of this. And that set of null geodesic comes with a tangent vector that happens to be a null vector that happens to be the normal to the hypersurface. So we have K alpha being the null normal to the hypersurface, and we have K alpha being tangent to the null geodesics that are, you know, tracing the surface like this. And we have this strange notion that the same vector can be both normal and tangent to a hypersurface. And the property of a vector to be both normal and tangent to something, well, has to do with the fact that it's a null vector, so its norm is actually zero. So that's the kind of situation that we encounter when we're discussing event horizons or null hypersurfaces, in more general terms. And that's something that I will, in time, develop more fully. So if it sounds strange at this point, well, it's because it is strange. But we'll take the time to get acquainted with those ideas as we get going. But the idea is that because we have this null surface and because we have this nice network of null geodesics that are all nice, nicely behaved, we never have crossing points because the vector field is non-singular. That's what, you know, at least we can imagine at this stage. We can basically understand something about the whole hypersurface by understanding something about the null geodesics that are tracing it. And I'll be using this, you know, this terminology later on, but we're talking about the null generators of a surface when we're talking about this network of null geodesics. And instead of saying network, we say congruences. So we are talking about a congruence of null geodesics. Congruence just means that you have a set of curves that basically pass through every point, never self-intersect, has all of those nice properties. And that's given to us here because we have a vector field. So, you know, remember that we can always associate integral curves to a vector field. That's what we're doing here. If the vector field is well behaved, the integral curves are going to be well behaved. And, you know, by congruence, we just mean this whole set of integral curves associated with that vector field. So that's going to be a central aspect of our description of event horizons when we get there. But what I want to do first is to start developing some technology to describe a set of curves like that. So that's going to be the starting point. That's what we're going to get into in just a few minutes. Why are we interested in this behavior here? Why are we interested in the behavior of this set of curves? Is because, well, as I was just saying, we can understand the hypersurface as a whole if we understand the behavior of the null generators in a case. And just to give you a teaser for what we're going to be talking about at some point, we're going to find that if we're talking specifically about a black hole event horizon, we're going to see that it's possible for the generators to fly apart. It's possible for the generators to fly apart. It's possible for the generators to stay put relative to one another. It's impossible for the generators to converge. So that's just, you know, a theorem that we can formulate, like Penrose did, that an event horizon is generated by curves like this that can fly apart or stay still, but never converge. We'll talk why about this, and I'll describe this more fully at some point. But the whole point is that, you know, if we understand, for example, that the generators are flying apart, well, intuitively, we can see right away that if the generators are all flying apart, the surface as a whole must be growing in size. If they don't fly apart but stay still like this, the surface as a whole doesn't change in size. If they fly apart, the surface grows. And what we have here is the area theorem. That's the Hawking famous area theorem that says that a horizon will never decrease in size. The area will always, well, either increase or stay the same. It will never decrease. And the reason, you know, the way of understanding this is to understand that the generators themselves are guaranteed to either fly apart or stay still but never converge. So by understanding the behavior of the null generators, we can say something so powerful like the area theorem that, you know, Hawking discovered, you know, in the 70s. So that's why we're interested in, you know, working out the behavior of the curves, because they give us a handle on how the hypersurface as a whole behaves, and eventually that will give us a key to, I'm not going to prove it, but I'm going to, you know, argue, I'm going to give you a plausibility argument that this gives us the area theorem, because we'll never have converging generators. They must fly apart or stay still. So bottom line is that if we're interested in things like this, and of course we will be, then to set up a technology where we can actually study the behavior of curves relative to other curves, you know, that's how we're going to see the property that they tend to diverge away or converge, you know, converge together. That's going to be comparing the behavior of this one relative to that one. So it's really the relative behavior of those curves that's going to be of importance to us. And how do we measure the relative behavior? Well, that's going to be through the gradient of the tangent vector field. So in order to understand what happens here, if I know what happens there, we have to work out the gradient. And the key quantity to study when we want to do all of this is to talk about the gradient of the null vector field that defines the event horizon for us. And the issue here is that, well, this is a very complicated object. You know, we have four vector components. We have the possibility of taking gradients in four directions. So this tensor that we're defining here, in principle, in fact, there are fewer than that, but in principle, could have 16 components. And that's a very complicated object to try and put, you know, to put our understanding into that object. So what we're going to do, and the reason for going through a very elaborate story, as I'm going to do in the several lectures, is to come up with a way of decomposing this into smaller pieces, each of which is going to be very much easier to understand. So we're going to break it down into all sorts of what's called irreducible pieces, and we're going to learn how to understand the meaning of each of those little pieces. And when we understand each piece individually, we'll be able to rebuild that very complicated object that is required to understanding, you know, the behavior of the hypersurface as a whole. So the whole point of the next several lectures is going to be to achieve a decomposition like this and try to understand what each member of the decomposition is supposed to mean. So I could start with a null vector field because that's going to be where, you know, we're going to be going eventually. But what we're going to do as preparation for this will be to introduce time-like curves, introduce the tangent vector field in, you know, as a velocity field, and we're going to be thinking of saying something about the gradient of a time-like velocity field. So we're going to use, you know, we're going to do this first as preparation for this, because that turns out to be a lot more straightforward. And once we know how to do it for a time-like vector field, you know, we're going to be better prepared to do it for a null vector field. But the main message is still the same, that we still have something involving 16 individual components. And that's something that also requires a breakdown into smaller pieces in order for us to understand what we can do with that kind of object. So before doing the null case, we're going to do the time-like case. And before doing all of this, we're going to do something in Newtonian physics because it's going to be a lot more straightforward. So we're going to go, you know, before we go the null case, so this is the time-like case. This was the null case. So the progression is that we're going to understand how to do the time-like case before we do the null case. But before we do any of this, we're going to do something in Newtonian physics. Because in Newtonian physics, we're going to be talking about spatial gradients. Let me write it as dj vk, where we're talking about a velocity vector that has three components, a gradient operation that has three independent directions. So we're going to be talking about nine, you know, individual components for that tensor in, you know, in 3D space. And the, you know, the idea is that, well, you know, that's already pretty complicated, lots of individual components. So we're going to do that first in the simplest conceivable context. And when we understand how to do it in Newtonian physics, we're going to be prepared to do it in space-time. And after that, we'll be able to take the step all the way to the null case. So it's a long story, but I wanted to prepare you for a rather long road, and I wanted to tell you why we're doing all of this in the steps that I'm doing. I'm basically starting with the simplest possible context to build it up to eventually here, where we're going to be using that as an essential input to our study of black holes. So that's where we're going with that. So I'm going to start slow. We're going to do some Newtonian physics for a while, and then we'll, you know, keep on introducing more complexity and eventually getting all the way to where we want to be. Okay, so let's get going with all of this. So in order to do, to get started with all of this in a Newtonian context where I think everything is, you know, nice and simple, we're going to need a velocity field. And, you know, the way we can, so I could introduce a velocity field purely in mathematical terms, but I think it's good to anchor that in some physics. So I'm going to, you know, think of a fluid, and the velocity field that we're introducing here is going to be the velocity field of some perfect fluid that in the end doesn't really play a role. The physics is not terribly important here. It's going to be the mathematical you know, description that matters. But I think it's good to anchor that into some, you know, physics that we might relate to. And we're going to use fluid mechanics as a way to achieve this. And I'm not going to go very deep into fluid mechanics. I think you know all the stuff that I'm going to be talking about. And the motivation here would be, well, there are certainly situations in fluid mechanics where we would be interested in the velocity gradient, because the velocity gradient appears in the Navier-Stokes equation, that is the, you know, governing equation for not a perfect fluid, but a viscous fluid. And the reason why we care about velocity gradient is because the viscosity is going to be, you know, acting when we have fluid elements that move with different velocity. If you have different fluid elements moving with different velocity, well, there's going to be a friction between the two, and that's going to generate heat. And if you want to understand the generation of heat in a viscous fluid, well, that's something that requires as an input the velocity gradient. So you don't get any viscous effects unless you have velocity gradients within your fluid. So that's why we might be interested in a velocity gradient. And sure enough, in fluid mechanics, because that's a complicated object, we decompose it into simpler objects and work in terms of those simpler things. It's very helpful to do that. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is mass conservation. Mass conservation is going to give us some intuition about a piece of the velocity gradient, namely the divergence of the velocity field. So that's where I'm going to be going with this. Okay, so let's think of a fluid. And the way I like to think of a fluid is, well, we have a continuum. So we have matter at every point in space. And we can think of the fluid as moving. You know, we can think of each little piece of a fluid, I'm calling it a fluid element, as moving on the word line that's going to be dictated to it by the laws of physics, like the Navier-Stokes equation. And we can look at the physics of each fluid element and then piece it all together to describe the fluid as a whole. So what we're going to have here is the congruence of fluid word lines. And I'm thinking of this as, you know, the motion of a tiny fluid element. And I can think of tracking this fluid element as it moves in time, you know, and I can do it for this little fluid element, I can do it for that one, and for all the other ones. So I have a fluid element that, you know, at a given time occupies, you know, a tiny volume in space that we idealize as a point in the continuum mechanics that we're doing here. And that fluid element, you know, if I track it, the way to track it would be, okay, take a little piece of the fluid and paint all the molecules red. And now you just follow all the red molecules for, you know, as long a time as you wish to do that. The fluid element will start, you know, diffusing. It will, you know, it will sort of deform in shape and all of this. But so long as the particles stay painted red, you can follow and track that fluid element for any given time. And that's how, for example, you can assign a velocity vector to that fluid element, and you can assign another one to that fluid element. And by comparing the two, you can start talking about a gradient of a velocity field, and that tells us how the fluid trajectories may be diverging or converging or standing still relative to one another. So that's the idea. So I'm introducing the fluid as a sort of physics anchor for the congruences that we're talking about here, the congruence of, you know, fluid trajectories or fluid element trajectories. All right. So a very important property of fluid mechanics is the fact that if I take my, you know, fluid element and I painted all the molecules red, well, the total mass of that fluid element will be the individual masses of all the molecules. And so long as I keep tracking this fluid element and include only in the fluid element the red particles, the mass of that fluid element will stay constant. So we're excluding chemical reactions that might change the mass, or excluding all sorts of complicated physics. We're just saying that, you know, the molecule will keep involving the same set of molecules, and I can track the fluid element and verify that the mass of that fluid element will be conserved in the course of the motion. Mass conservation, of course, is something we've encountered before, or maybe you've encountered, you know, charge conservation. And there's an equation that captures this, and I'm not going to derive it because you've seen it before. It's the continuity equation that tells us that the rate of change of density plus the divergence of the density current, current density, that's zero. So that's an equation I'm going to start with, consider it to be well known and well understood. And that's the equation that we normally refer to as the continuity equation. And here, rho would be the density of mass, v is the velocity field. If we're talking about conservation of charge, rho would be the charge density. Lots of things satisfy that equation. Namely, anything that's conserved will have a conservation equation that looks like this. So we're going to take that for granted. But what I want to do is to re-express this in a way that's going to emphasize the fluid element version of this, or the, you know, we're going to really see what happens to a given fluid element as we follow its motion in time. This doesn't quite do it, because that time derivative here that we're introducing here specifically means take a time derivative at a fixed position. So we would be comparing the density here to the density here at, you know, a slightly later time. That's what that derivative means. But if I'm thinking, you know, in terms of fluid element, that fluid element in that time interval is going to be moving up here. So what I want to do here is to introduce a different time derivative that will actually account for the motion of the fluid element during the time interval. That's what in fluid mechanics is known as a material derivative, or a convective derivative, or a total derivative. Many names are associated with that. But the idea is that if I'm going to, you know, follow the motion of a fluid element, when I take a time derivative, I actually want to account for the motion of the fluid element during the time interval. So during a time interval dt, the fluid element is going to move by an amount v dt. So if I want to calculate the change in density, you know, at those two different times, but for the same fluid element. So let's draw the picture. So I have the fluid element at the initial time, and I have the fluid element at a slightly later time. What the fluid element will do is to move by an amount v dt. And what I want to do here is to compare the density here versus the density there. So I don't compare the density at the fixed position. I compare the density at the new position of the fluid element compared to what it used to be at the old position. So that material derivative, let's call it that, or let's call the material change, I'm going to call that d rho. So, you know, introduce a notation to distinguish from what we had before. That, by definition, will be the density at the new time and the new position minus the density at the old time and the old position. So that's the new type of derivative that I want to introduce here to describe the physics of that fluid element in more, in more sort of appropriate ways, instead of, you know, that time derivative over here where we stay at the same position, but the fluid element has flown off to a new position. So we're really taking that, you know, fluid element centric point of view here when we're doing this. And so if we agree that this is, you know, an important way of characterizing the change in density, then we can work it out, because I can do a Taylor expansion on this. So it's going to be the density at dl time and dl position plus a couple of derivative terms. So first I have the derivative with respect to the first argument here, which is the partial t with fixed position. And then I will have the spatial derivatives here that multiplies the displacement, which is vj times t. And then I subtract again the density at the old time and old position that came from here. So the full derivative that we're constructing here will involve, dt. That full derivative here involves the partial dt plus a term that accounts for the motion of the fluid element during that time interval. So if I divide through by dt, then the material derivative of the density, by definition, is going to be the partial change plus the change that's produced by the motion of the fluid element during that time interval. And the point is that the physics is more easy, you know, it's easier to identify through this time derivative, because we can really think of the fluid element as, you know, a little particle, and we follow the motion of that particle in time, and we, you know, look at the forces acting on that, and we're looking at things like the mass inside that little particle. So the physics is really clearly identified when we move with the particle. And if you're thinking about this, well, that looks a lot like what we talked about previously when we were constructing derivatives along a Ward line. That's exactly what we're doing. So that's the Newtonian version of what we've been doing a lot, you know, in previous lectures, and introduce, directional derivatives along a Ward line. That's exactly what we're doing here, except that we're using Newtonian language to describe this instead of relativistic language. But it's the same concept, and, No, that's all I can say about that. Okay, so now we've introduced, you know, a time derivative operation that is perhaps more appropriate to describe the physics of a fluid element. What I would like to do is to recast the equation of continuity in terms of that time derivative. So we're going to just do the exercise of rewriting the continuity equation in that new language. And in order to do that, well, I'm going to just expand out that divergence that we have. We have a product there. So I'm just going to say that, well, the first term in that expansion is going to be precisely the thing that combines with the partial time derivative to give us the material derivative. And then we're left over with rho divergence of the vector field. And now we're saying something that is starting to look, you know, pretty meaningful. We're saying that the continuity equation can be re-expressed in terms of the material derivative of the density plus something that involves the divergence of the vector field. And through that, we can assign direct physical meaning to the divergence. Now, I could have started a discussion by saying that the divergence measures, you know, the degree by which a vector field spreads out from any given direction. And I think you'd be familiar with this, but I think it's nice to see it emerging through that discussion of fluid elements, because we can relate it directly to the fractional rate of change of the density. So that's the new version of the continuity equation. And yet another way of writing this out is to say that the divergence of the vector field, let's put the minus sign here, measures with a minus sign the fractional rate of change of the density, with, you know, the rate of change being measured in terms of the material derivative that follows the fluid element. So that measures the fractional rate of change of the density. So what I wanted to do with this, and I'll, you know, firm this up even more in just a moment, is to, you know, do this story just to emphasize the fact that the divergence of a vector field has an immediate physical meaning, something that we can, you know, express in terms of the density of a fluid element. But it turns out that there's something even more fundamental than this, because why is the density changing? Well, the density is changing not because the mass is changing, all the while we were supposing that the mass of a fluid element is constant. So if the density is changing, that means that the volume is changing. So I can rewrite this very quickly in terms of a rate of change of volume, and we're going to see that the divergence is actually measuring this rate of change of, you know, of volume. So what is density? Well, the density is the mass of a fluid element divided by its volume. So the mass is conserved, therefore the rate of change of density is going to be the rate, you know, it's going to be related to the rate of change of volume. So we just do the calculation, we get minus m over v squared, and then we get the volume derivative. So here I'm thinking of a small fluid element, so that's the mass of the fluid element times its, you know, tiny little volume, and now I'm accounting for the change in density through the change in volume. I can rewrite this as minus the density divided by the volume. And if I divide through by density, I get exactly what I have on the left-hand side, and I also kill that minus sign. So all of this tells me that, you know, even if I didn't deal with fluid, a fluid with an actual, you know, mass or anything like this, I would still have an interpretation for the divergence of the vector field, because if I'm thinking of a, you know, a flow of some kind with volumes attached to that flow, then the divergence of the vector field that measures the spread out of the flow, that would actually be concretely measured in terms of a fractional rate of change of volume. So that's the conclusion, and I think that's going to be enough for this morning. We can relate the divergence of the vector field directly into the rate of change of the volume. So what this says is that the divergence of a vector field is really measuring the fractional rate of change of tiny volumes. So even if we're, you know, abstracting away the fluid here, we can think of, you know, the vector field as giving us a flow. Those are the integral curves of the vector field. We can attach a little cube to each word line and see how that cube behaves as a function of time. And we would see that if the vector field diverges out like this, has a positive divergence, that would translate into, sorry, did I lose a minus sign here? No, it's fine. So if the vector field diverges out, that means that the volumes are expanding, and the divergence of the vector field measures that fractional rate of change. If the flow is converging together, the divergence would be negative. That would be measured by a decrease of those tiny volumes. And the whole point of the exercise here is to associate something very physically meaningful to something that initially might be just a mathematical construction. So that's the idea. So we've already isolated one piece of the velocity gradient. The rest of the story this afternoon will be to identify the remaining pieces, because that's, you know, just a very specific combination of this velocity field gradient. We're going to look at the remaining coefficients and see if we can, you know, also give them an interpretation. And, you know, the spoiler alert here is that here we're talking about how a volume element expands or decreases in size in the course of the evolution. The other pieces, you know, are going to describe how it deforms in shape. So if we start out with a cube, as a result of the evolution of the fluid, that fluid element will deform and become something more complicated than a cube. And that's something that's described to us by the remaining components of the velocity field gradient. So that's what we're going to do this afternoon. And after we've done all of this, we'll be able to promote that understanding to space-time. All right, any questions about any of this here? Mm-hmm.
there and talk about something else. But talking about the other side, where you mentioned the word gradient, where you use the indices on the other one.
Right.
You're no longer, because that was a question of something, the partial, each of those components, you're no longer summing up like that.
Right. So here, yeah, I'm really talking about the individual components. So I have, a two-tensor. But if I take a contraction, then that's what gives me the divergence. And that's just a small piece of that general tensor.
Okay, so the one with the indices is not that. You're not summing.
Here I'm summing, yeah.
Over there,
I'm not summing because the indices are different. And here the divergence, of course, would be the same thing as, that thing where we would have an implied summation.
You write both on the bottom.
Oh yeah, so here I'm being Newtonian, so in Newtonian people don't know anything about upstairs indices and downstairs indices, but that would be better. Right. Okay, so let's stop now and we'll pick up the story again this afternoon. Any questions online? Sorry.
Thank you, I'm good.
All good? Okay, so let's reconvene in the afternoon.